Welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. With this podcast, we want to give voices to many coastal scientists and engineers so we can meet them, at least virtually, and hear curious and less curious questions. My name is Ana Vila Concejo, and today I am having a chat with Rob Brander from the University of New South Wales. Rob Brander, also known as Dr. Rip, has had a long career researching beach processes and rip currents. He is very active in science communication and also in educating politicians and policymakers on surf safety. So much that his research has shifted from what used to be more like coastal processes and beach processes towards what he calls beach safety. I'm sure he will explain to us what that is. Hi, Rob. Thank you for agreeing to this interview. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Rob is a busy man. He's been so busy that I offer to do this interview in person. I really cycle past his office on my way to work. And he declined because he thought we would be carried away and talk too much. What has been keeping you so busy, Rob? Can you share with us, or is it secret?
No, I don't know. I think I must be doing something wrong, because I understand when you get to become a professor, you're supposed to achieve at a higher level, but I've never been busier than I have been the last year. So I must be doing something wrong, time management skills. But I guess it's everything in academia. I mean, I have a fairly high teaching load, and that keeps you busy, of course. And there's always more admin associated with academia these days. But research-wise, my research career is probably pumping along better than it ever has before. And we've sort of started this beach, what we call a beach safety research group here at UNSW. And we've got too many projects, to be honest. And we're doing a lot of work at the moment with National Parks, New South Wales, doing a coastal water safety strategy for them, amongst a bunch of other things. And there's just a lot of projects. And I think I need to start learning to say no. Lots of papers coming out. And then I do a lot of outreach. So I do a lot of science communication, as you mentioned. And that just takes time. And dealing with media, it's just a very time-consuming thing. So on all three fronts of academia, I'm busy. And then there's the family, right?
Okay, you will tell us about that in a moment. So let's go to the questions. The objective is to keep this to 30 minutes because, you know, no one wants to listen to us for longer. So the first question is, how did you start in coastal science?
Yeah, so, you know, as a teenager at high school, I was always interested in physical geography because I went to the Rocky Mountains on doing some hiking and I liked mountains. So that's why I took physical geography at University of Toronto. And then Brian Greenwood was my first year physical geography lecturer. And he was, you know, I found his lectures interesting. Most people didn't. I don't know if he's listening to this, but most people didn't. But I found his lectures interesting. And I always liked the beach anyway. And I started to realize, well, there probably wasn't a future in mountains, but there was more of a future in studying something coastal. So I think at the end of that course, I asked him, I said, look, do you hire students to help you out with your research? And he said, yes, but you must get your scuba diving license, which I eventually did. And then I think by my third year, I started working with him and I was taking his courses and we would go away for 2 months every year at the beginning of summer and do these big experiments. And that was that. And I was hooked. So yeah, the topic interested me, and then also the field work really interested me.
And so you started in Toronto, and then when did you move to Australia?
Yeah, so I did my undergrad and master's with Brian at University of Toronto, and then, yeah, I wanted, and Brian was very insistent that, you know, I wanted to do a PhD, and he said, well, you need to go elsewhere, which I think is a good bit of advice, but I also wanted to backpack, right? Go backpacking. So after I finished my master's, I took sort of a 9 months off and my first stop was Sydney because I just wanted to snorkel on the Barrier Reef and swim in the beaches there. And it, literally on the second day, I went into Sydney Uni to go see Andy Short because I was kind of angling for a PhD in this trip. And Andy right away, you know, it's a nice little meeting, but then he slogged me off to talk to Gerd Maslink and Ian Turner and Guy Lessa, who are PhDs there. And they said, oh, well, we're doing some field work up in Yeppoon in February, which is a month away. Why don't you come and join us? And I did. And getting to meet them, becoming friends with them, and just opening my eyes to this amazing coastline that I'd never seen, you know, within a year, I was back doing my PhD at Sydney.
There you go. So you didn't go backpacking?
Oh, I did. I had a great time backpacking. But the interesting thing was, actually, there was a Second day I was there, Andy introduced me to Ian Turner. And Ian Turner took me to Bronte Beach with some of his friends. And I still remember standing there overlooking the beach with Ian, and he's pointing out this amazing rip current. And I said, "Oh, great. I've been studying rips, but of all the beaches I'd been to, I'd never actually seen one." So I said, "Where is it?" And he's saying, "Well, it's right there." And I just could not see this rip. And for me, that was a defining moment because I thought, hang on, how can I be? I've studied these things out of textbooks. How can I not see it? And it was that little seed, and I got interested in rips, and I found out how important they were scientifically, but also, that they're a drowning hazard. And when I eventually met Ian and Gerd doing their field work in Yeppoon, we talked about rips a lot, and that became what I wanted to do for my PhD, which I got a scholarship for the next year.
That's amazing. So everything kind of worked together and was aligned. That's good. Okay, so you have already told us how busy you are, and you did mention your personal life as well. How do you balance your life commitments with your work commitments? How do you do it?
Not very well. I don't know. I always envy those academics who've balanced it well. It's always a challenge. And a lot of us tend to be workaholics. I certainly was until I got married, and then that changes things. So I think I tended to work incredibly hard. I still do, but too hard until I got married, and then you have kids, and then I always remember when I was doing my PhD with Andy Short, and I lived in his basement for a couple of months, and he'd work at home a lot, and we'd go to the beach, and I just remember him seeing him with his kids, throwing them around the surf, and just this look of joy on his face, right? And having this conversation where he said, "Look, your kids are only young once, right? You need to spend time with them," and that hit home. So I think once I had kids, I really stepped back. I stopped doing much field work. I stopped going away. I don't go to many conferences. I try not to work weekends. It doesn't always work, but yeah, I think overall I'm better, but there's still, I still think I probably work too much when I should be spending more time with my family at times.
Fair enough. As far as there are peaks and lulls, yeah.
Yeah,
So,
absolutely.
what are your interests or hobbies? What did you like to do when you're not working? Working?
Yeah, no, I guess my main hobby or passion is body surfing. I fell in love with body surfing as soon as I caught a wave at Bondi Beach when I was backpacking. And I body surf a lot. But to be honest with you, when I think now, I don't actually body surf that much. It's sort of like, yeah, I love going body surfing, but I don't really body surf as much as I used to. And then, of course, yeah, when you get married as well, you get busy. And so most of my hobbies at the moment are driving my kids to sport and to work, but I still body surf when I can. But that's my passion.
That's fair enough. I think many of us have transformed our hobbies into carrying children around.
Yeah, that's my hobby.
Okay, so I think that we have a nice area of research. It's a nice area. Most people are friendly and collegial and so on. But of course, there is always room for improvement. What would you change to make it a better place?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you're right. Starting off as a young academic or student, really, and I was lucky enough to go on these big field experiments with Brian Greenwood, and I met people like Tony Bowen and David Huntley, who were at Dalhousie, some big names in the field. And then there was Doug Sherman and Bernie Bauer from USC. And it was back then, it was quite a serious business. But you'd work hard, play hard, but the science was taken very seriously. And there was, I think, a lot of elements of competitiveness. And I've seen this through the years with physical geography and geomorphology, which is my field, that especially when it comes time to reviewing grants and reviewing papers, we can be bastards, right? We can be really hard on ourselves. And then at UNSW, our school merged with biology and ecology. And I would see in their field that they're much more accepting of each other and they're nicer to each other. And I think that's improved. I think over the years, we're not the sort of hard scientists that we used to be. I think we're a bit more open and collaborative and friendly, but I still think there's that element there of and I don't know where it originated from with coastal science, and just maybe it's a hard working environment for one. And yeah, I think we can maybe help ourselves out when it comes to being a bit nicer for reviews.
I completely agree with you. So I spent the last 4 years as a reviewer for the Australian Research Council in the College of Experts. And the reviews that earth scientists do for each other are really harsh, like it's
Yeah.
so striking. So yes, I
And
think
you
that's
see
a
that
point.
at conferences. I don't go to many physical conferences anymore, but when I did, a lot of the questioning was quite aggressive, right?
Yes.
Not supportive, but aggressive. And I think it's improving, but I still think we can get better in that regard.
That's a great point. I like it. Okay, going back to research, can you tell us about your favorite paper or a paper that you read and changed your research?
Yeah, well, there is one that sticks out. I don't know if it's my favorite paper, but it's one that certainly changed my perspective. When I was doing my master's degree at University of Toronto with Brian Greenwood, it was pretty much about fundamental sediment transport in the surf zone sediment transport. And I remember Phil Osborne was doing his PhD there, and we were friends as well. And he just slapped this paper on my desk, which was the Wright and Tom coastal depositional landforms, a morphodynamic approach, right, which is 1977. And he said, look at this. This is what we should be doing. And I read this paper because, and this is not a criticism of my undergraduate degree, but when I did coastal geomorphology as an undergrad, it was pretty much hardcore wave sediment transport. We never saw anything about beach types. We never really saw much about morphodynamics. And I thought, well, here's a systematic approach that is really telling you how the coast behaves. And sure, there's scope for fundamental basic research, but this was really grabbed my interest. And I read that paper and it just gave me a whole new perspective. And when I did go on this backpacking trip and I did meet Andy Short and he said, well, what are you interested in? And I said, well, I don't know, morphodynamics. And he sort of said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, something bigger. But yeah, that was a paper that I guess really opened my eyes to a whole different area of what I thought at the time was coastal geomorphology.
I agree with you. Those papers were really seminal, yeah, and inspired
Oh,
big
and
time.
sometimes it's nice to go back and read that paper again. And it's also nice to go back and read some of the old papers. So, rip currents is what I've spent most of my time doing. But you go back and even in some of these early papers in the late 1920s and 1940s and 50s, there's some nuggets in there. Like it's qualitative and it's descriptive, but it's a lot of it's bang on. It's fascinating stuff.
It is great. Can you briefly explain one of your topics of research to our listeners?
Yep. I mean, I'll explain beach safety research, which is what I now do and what I call myself, a beach safety researcher. So beach safety research is sort of a multidisciplinary approach, if you like, that incorporates elements of physical science, so physical coastal geomorphology, with social science methods. So looking at people, so doing surveys and questionnaires of people, doing workshops, doing focus group sessions. It incorporates elements of psychology, behavior, epidemiology, a lot, and communication with the overall goal of trying to produce research or trying to produce outputs and findings that are going to have an impact on ultimately reducing drowning on beaches. And that's basically, yeah, that's what I do. And that's pretty much what I've done for the last 15 years. And I started off as a physical rip current scientist, if you like. And then I also started doing my own little community education program to help people understand rip currents and beach safety. And then I worked out that, I can make this into research, and that's what I do now. So I like to think that beach safety research is research with impact, real world impact, because we are trying to save lives.
I agree. How difficult is it to get funding for a for research that is so multidisciplinary?
Well, it's getting funding's always hard. We've had good luck with ARC linkages with this. I've never had a discovery, and I'm not even going to go down that route. I shouldn't tell. My employers might be listening, but we've had good linkages with Surf Life Saving Australia. They've always been our industry partner, and there's an obvious connection between you've got a serious societal problem, people drowning on the coast in large numbers, and we have that scientific expertise. And then if you get your team together, you get a physical scientist, you get somebody with a background in drowning prevention, you get a social scientist, you can develop some pretty powerful teams with track records. So we've found it, I wouldn't say easy, it's never easy to get funding, but we've done okay.
That's
And I think it's the fact that, these reviewers can see one, that the topic's important, and of course they see that the team is strong, and they see that you know what you're going to do, and it's not nebulous, that your results, your outcomes, they can see a pathway towards how that's actually going to affect change.
I remember many years ago you mentioning that you really wanted to have a video on surf safety on the planes arriving to Australia. Has that happened?
No, we've made lots of videos. I mean, UNSW, we made this video called How to Survive Beach Rip Currents. This is back in 2008. It's now got 1.7 million YouTube views or something really high. But at the time, there was no video about rip currents. And Surf Life Saving Australia didn't have a video. And I remember we said, well, we'd like to make this video. And they said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. And I thought, yeah, of course it's a good idea. Why hasn't it been done? So we've made a bunch of, there's a lot of different videos I could go on, and they reach whatever audience they reach. And one of the things we're not very good at is evaluating the impact of those videos and the effectiveness. Are they actually making sense to people? Are they helping people? But we have tried to contact video airlines over the years with Surf Life Saving, with Dr. Carl Krushelnicki, who's a popular media personality here. And it's just a wall goes up. It's just almost impossible to get anything on them. And I don't blame the airlines because the airlines are just carriers, but I do think the government should be saying, look, everyone arriving in Australia needs to see a safety video. It could be 20 seconds, 30 seconds about beach safety. It's so important. The only success we had was that several years ago, I was involved in making a Rip Current documentary called Rip Current Heroes that was done by National Geographic. That ended up on the Qantas and Jetstar in-flight video stuff until COVID hit and then it disappeared. That's the only time we've got on planes.
Many things disappeared with COVID, but this podcast started with
There you
COVID.
go.
So, okay, Rob, you have done lots of field work over your career. What are the wildest field conditions that you have encountered?
The wildest? Yeah, the wild easy. That's Muriwai Beach on Auckland's East Coast beaches, right? So after the PhD with Andy, which was on rip currents, we'd done a lot of great field measurements up at Palm Beach, Sydney's northern beaches. And then we thought, well, we want to do something big. Let's measure a big rip current. And those West Coast Auckland beaches like Muriwai and Piha have outrageously big rips because they've got outrageously big surf. I mean, the waves are almost 2.5 meters every day. So we said, yeah, let's go over. And it also had a mesotidal tide range, which we thought would be allow us to get our instruments in at low tide. And we thought naively that we'd be able to get these big instrument pods with the current meters into the rip head, so the main throat of the rip. No way. These rips were just incredibly fast, incredibly strong, and the best we could do was just to get our big heavy pods literally 2 meters off the shoreline into the feeder. That was the best we could do, and even then, one of them sort of disappeared and went cartwheeling away. So we thought, well, what are we going to do? These rips were ferocious. So we ended up doing rip floats, where I think Bruce Tom and Andy originated these, where you jump in the rip, you have two theodolites on the dunes, and you basically triangulate, every 30 seconds where this person is. And we would float offshore. You'd be flying along the feeder along the beach. It was like a ride. It was so fast. And then you would turn the corner and you wouldn't even notice it really. And before you know it, there's just walls of water. You can barely see the beach, and you're about 300, 400 meters offshore. And Andy and I did these rip floats, and we had the IRB from the surf club picking us up, which was great. And that was wild. But the wildest thing was that we were surveying as well. We were doing dumpy or theodolite surveys back then. Maybe it was total station, can't remember. But Andy was on the bar at low tide, and the feeder, the trough was about, I don't know, 30, 40 meters wide with this honking feeder current. And I'm surveying with the stadia rod, and I'm swimming across this rip because I couldn't touch the feeder bottom, but I wanted to get that edge of the bar, that the slope, right? Anyway, so I'm sort of halfway into the feeder, halfway on this bar, holding the stadia rod, looking back at the guys in the dune, and then this wall of water comes across this shallow bar, and it went from ankle deep to just like a meter deep, and it just washed me into the feeder. And right away, I'm in the feeder, and I'm going. And I'm trying to swim back with this stadia rod, and I couldn't get back on because of all the turbulence coming off. And I thought, okay, I'm in a bit of trouble here. And Andy recognized that, and he had some fins, and he threw me the fins. And I'm trying to put the fins on. Meanwhile, I'm just flying at about 2 meters per second. And I just thought, if and no one was around except us. And I thought, if I turn the corner, I'm looking at a helicopter rescue. So I just kind of swam as fast as I could across the feeder back to the shore, barely made it. And I remember just crawling up the beach and just thought and collapsing. And I was scared. I remember just being angry and scared. It was scary. And I remember Dave Mitchell and Michael Hughes were surveying at the dune, and they said, if you had dropped the stadia rod, that was our signal to call for help. But it would have taken ages. So that was pretty scary. That was wild. That rip was intense. Yeah.
That sounds very scary. Do you have a favorite fieldwork place?
Yeah, that's easy too. The Maldives. So I didn't always study rips. I became friends with Paul Kench when he was at the University of Auckland. I think we'd met at a few conferences and we just got along, and Paul was doing a lot of coral reef island research back then. We ended up, he invited me, he and Roger McLean had a PhD student, Deirdre Hart, and they invited me up to a experiment up in Torres Strait. But anyway, then Paul invited me to help out with some of his Maldives experiments. And the first one we went on was establishing survey benchmarks. I think it was like 14 or 15 uninhabited islands on this particular atoll. And we would, and the whole point was to get these bench, get a long-term monitoring program going of island change. And it was like old time science, right? We had a boat and we would just go from island to island, and we had some of the Maldivian crew were helping us out, and we'd establish these benchmarks and we just do surveys, right? It was so easy, but it was surveys across the reef flat to the reef edge. And it was just, I felt like, I mean, you study all this stuff, you know all the old names. I felt like the old coral reef scientist from the 40s and 50s. And it was brilliant. And you're in the middle of nowhere on these islands. And for me, that environment was fantastic. And, you know, we went back, ended up going about four times to the Maldives and loved it. And it was a hard environment. As you know, you end up walking a lot around these islands, and chafe is always an issue. It's hard work and it's hot. But yeah, beautiful. So I love the Maldives.
We'll have to bring you to do some coral research again.
Yeah, I haven't done it in 15 years, more actually, which is a bit embarrassing. Well, just time flying.
Time flies, exactly. What is the strangest thing that you have seen at the coast or on a beach?
I mean, I haven't seen a lot of, people have asked me this before, and there's not a lot of, I haven't actually seen a lot of strange things, but the strangest thing that happened was, again, during this famous backpacking trip after my master's, when I went and helped Gerd Maslink and Ian Turner do their PhD field work at a beach north of Yeppoon called 9 Mile Beach, which was quite remote. And this is February, central Queensland. It was stinking hot. They were in a tent. We had this big tent set up, and they had their trailer with the computer gear and stuff, and wild weather. And then one night we were just sitting on the beach, possibly drinking alcohol, and it was dark. And then all of a sudden the darkness just got darker. And without a word, we just saw it. Something's happening here. And we just ran back into the tent because it was obviously some sort of storm approaching. And then bam, just this wind, almost like this cyclonic wind, just hit us. And it was intense. And I at you know the tent was buffeting. And I remember at first, you know, Gerd was sort of holding on onto the tent with a beer in one hand and laughing. And then it wasn't funny, because then it was, we were holding on to this tent for survival. And there was lightning going on, and it was thunder. And then somebody sent, we had an undergraduate with us, his name Adam, and we sent Adam out. He said, somebody better look at the gear to see if it's okay, the instruments on the beach. So I remember the tent opening and the flashing lights and the rain, and then Adam runs out, and then he comes back in and he's yelling, there's camels on the beach. And we're going, what? There's camels on the beach. And so we run out to see what's going on, and it was like this Vietnam experience. It was, not that I've been to Vietnam during the war, but you know, flashing lights, thunder, rain, this assault on your senses. And there was a herd of cattle running along the beach in this beach in central Queensland. It was surreal. And so we were running along waving so they wouldn't trample the instruments. And then this tempest or whatever it was just disappeared, and things settled down, and everything was trash. But seeing those cows on the beach was weird.
It's just good that you started by saying that you had not seen many weird things on the beach, because that's pretty weird.
That was well, I wish there had been camels, but yeah, that was quite the trip.
Okay, going back to science. Do you think we can predict long-term morphodynamic changes beyond the Kármán scales?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be honest. I've moved away a lot from coastal morphodynamics. I'm not up on the literature as much as I should be, but I can't see why we can't. I mean, there's I from looking outside a little bit now, it used to be we'd launch these massive fieldwork campaigns on beaches, and that's how we would understand how things work. And to my mind, not as many of those are happening anymore, but we're getting more advanced with remote sensing, with camera imagery, and now AI and all the sort of stuff. Like I talk a lot to Mitch Harley and Eunice W, so I see what he's doing. And I think, well, you know, why not? I mean, why can't we predict that sort of stuff? And I think we can. I think technology will lead that. Whether we get it right, I don't know, but certainly modeling is getting better and better all the time. So I would say yes.
Okay, good. Okay, now thinking forward, this question is about the future. Can you think of a major advance in coastal science that will happen in the next 50 years? I mean, I call this question is like the crystal ball one. What do you think is going to revolutionize coastal science in the next 50 years?
I don't know. It's kind of like, I guess that would relate to, well, what are the big unanswered questions that's driving most of what we do? And, you know, trying to predict morphodynamic change is one of them. But it's interesting. I've always been interested in the behavior of the beaches where I live on the East Coast. You know, there was the research that started coming out about how beaches respond, beach rotation responds to ENSO cycles, right? Which is interesting. But it's much, you know, and I will try and explain to people who don't understand coastal science or my students, you know, okay, you get it on the east coast of Australia, we get an El Nino, the sand comes back, and then you go into La Nina phase, you get storms, and the sand disappears. But that recovery process is fascinating for me. It's easy to see when we get big east coast lows or east coast cyclones, big storms, the sand goes offshore, and then there's various time periods for it to come back. But one of the interesting questions for me is, where does that sand go? Right? The sand invariably comes back, but sometimes it comes back quickly, sometimes it takes a long time. And I remember, actually, I had Mitch Harley come in and give a guest lecture for my third year coastal course this year, and this issue came up, and Mitch was basically saying, well, we understand the nearshore zone pretty well in terms of where sand's coming and going. But we don't really know a little bit beyond that, or I guess to the, you know, the outer shore face, where is this big lump of sand going? And they've tried all these things, of course, with airborne LIDAR to map out the volumetric beach change and the locations. But it's a good question. Where does that sand go? And how is it going to come back? And to me, that has huge implications for understanding and predicting the sort of beach behavior over those longer timescales. Where does it go?
Absolutely, I'm with you. I always say that I want a sensor that can look through water,
Yeah,
so see what happens
don't we
beyond.
all?
Well, we can still ask. Okay, and the next question, I think you're going to have a good answer for this, because it's about the which other contributions to society do you do through your work? Do you do mentoring? We know that you do a lot of outreach. Perhaps you want to talk about that. What would you like to tell us about your other activities?
Yeah, I think my outreach is kind of taken over pretty much what I do, and it originated out of a passion for, I love beaches. I grew up going to beaches. Beaches for me are a place of joy, and when you see somebody drown at a beach, as I have, it just resonated with me that I had this knowledge of how, for example, rip currents worked, and I just felt I needed to get that out to people. And that started off my community. I called it the Science of the Surf presentation, which I would give at local surf clubs, in my local surf club in Sydney at Tamarama. And I would just talk to people about, or give a presentation, almost like a lecture, about how beaches work, but with a beach safety theme. And then we'd put the purple dye in the rip current afterwards. And I started to feel that had an impact. Like people would come up to me and say, look, I've grown up next to the coast and all my life, and no one has ever explained this to me. And I thought, really? Wow. And so I started doing this into schools, and this program grew, and I started doing videos and educate, and it became a passion. So that is, and I haven't stopped. And it's very time consuming, but it can be extremely rewarding. And I get emails, and I've even had letters from people from different countries who've said, "Look, my daughter was drowning in a rip current, but because we watched your video, we knew what to do," and this sort of thing. And I've had that kind of response, and that's when it really does tell me that if I've saved even one life through what I've done, that's been worthwhile. And I don't think my hardcore physical science research necessarily was directly doing that, but I think the beach safety research I'm doing and all the outreach efforts I do is making a difference. And I think that's important for, in the early days, any of our scientists, if we did media, you weren't laughed at, but it was a bit of a joke, right? Oh, he's a media, blah, 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 blah. But now science communication is such a huge part of what we do, and it's recognized by universities. So I'll always do outreach, and I'll always try and educate people about rip currents and how to spot them and do whatever I can to do it. And but now I don't do as much face to face as I used to, but now it's gone up a little bit. So I am working with, national parks, New South Wales. I'm working with the federal government on beach safety messaging and Surf Life Saving Australia. So I'm kind of taking it to a higher level.
So, are you managing to influence politicians in bit safety?
That's a tough one. There is, one particular politician, our local member, he has a background in life saving, so he gets it. And I was asked to go to Parliament House in Canberra just a few days ago to present to them, to MPs, about how to spot a rip current and the problems with rip currents, and try and say, well, look, this is a big problem. So yeah, I mean, whether that pays off, but you just got to keep chipping away. And all it takes is for a couple of politicians to see the value in this, and then you go from there. So, we're talking about trying to improve messaging or increase messaging beyond the swimming between the flags message in Australia. And if we can do that, that would be huge.
That would be amazing indeed. Okay, so we have arrived to the last question, which is what was the best or worst advice that you ever received? Or basically, what would you tell to your former self, to the backpacker that arrived in Australia? What would you say?
Put on more sunscreen. Yeah, I've been asked this question before, and it's I've had great mentors throughout my career: Brian Greenwood, Andy Short, Gerd Maslach, Ian Turner, Troels Agard. There's been a lot. I can't. There's not one particular piece of advice that stands out to me that I received. If there's one piece of advice I'd wish I'd been given, it would be to learn how to say no. And I think a lot of us would wish we learn how to say no a bit more. But I think if I was to look back at my younger self, or any younger academic coming through, PhD student who wants to be an academic, don't be so hard on yourself. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. It's kind of the nature of what we do. There is a lot of pressure. Academia is stressful. I don't care what anyone says, it's very stressful. But don't put too much pressure, and also follow your strengths and passions. So I spent, the beginning, I loved doing my undergrad and master's with Brian Greenwood, and I enjoyed my PhD, but it was always stressful for me because I loved doing the field work, but I was never good at math. I was never good at physics, and doing all of that hardcore coastal geomorphology was a struggle. And in the background, I felt like a bit of an imposter, really, because I'm publishing papers and about stuff that some of the hardcore theory I barely really understood. So when I morphed into doing all the beach safety research and a lot of the social science research, which involves communication, it still involves number crunching, but I just felt comfortable with that. And the relief, this pressure I'd been carrying for so long, this burden was lifted. So yeah, follow what you're good at.
Yeah, well, I have to say here, and I think we still have a bit of time. You were one of the persons that told me to say yes, Rob. So when I
What?
so when I moved here to Australia, you were going to take leave without pay. Yeah,
That's
remember?
right. Yeah.
And you needed someone to
Yeah.
backfill your teaching position. And I remember talking with you and saying, oh, I don't have that much teaching experience and so on. It's like, no, Anna, you can do this. You can do this. And I went to the interview and Yes, I can do this. And I got the job. So, you know,
Well,
you
that's good advice, of course.
know.
But I mean, in terms of it, when people say saying no to too many projects, right? You have to realize there's a limit to what you can do before you start to break down. So you did need more teaching experience. I'll take full credit for everything that's come since.
Okay, good. So before going to our final quick questions, is there something that you would like to say that you haven't had a chance to say?
I think one of the things I've enjoyed over the years and is just working with everybody. I mean, the coastal field, like I mentioned before, when I grew up, it was aggressive, it was competitive. But if you think it's a good vibe in the field now. I mean, there's so many friends I've made through this, and I like to think that they are friends. They're not just colleagues, they're friends. And I think when you get older, you can reflect that, yeah, you are friends. And I think it's important to spend. Yeah, no, it's been a great experience. I've loved being an academic. I've loved the field work over the years. I don't do much anymore, but I'm always so appreciative of everyone who's helped me through my career, big time.
That's a great reflection. Okay, our final quick questions. We're wrapping up. Don't think too much. Just give me the first answer that comes to your mind. Favorite band, music, or composer?
Yeah, easy. Genesis, but early Genesis. With Peter Gabriel. After Peter Gabriel left, they had one or two good albums, and then they just went into rubbish. But the early Genesis was, for me, progressive. I loved it. It was so weird. No one else liked it. But listen to Selling England by the Pound and Foxtrot and Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. Yeah. I have my big Genesis phases, but they've always been my favorite.
Cool. Favorite dish or signature dish?
Eating wise?
Yes.
I have to say it's pizza. Honestly, like at the end of the day, if I want something to eat, pizza, and it's got to be good pizza.
Did you cook?
Oh yeah, I make good homemade pizzas, yeah.
Oh,
I
good.
just but I slather them with jalapenos and hot sauce, so all you really experience is extreme heat. But it's good.
The latest book you read.
Ah, I just finished rereading Lord of the Rings, actually, which I've read multiple times, but not for quite a long time. And to be honest, I found it a little bit long-winded. I've always loved it. I've always thought it's the best book ever and my favorite book, but maybe it's the recent exposure to social media. I've lost my attention span, but I found it a bit long-winded. But then I always move on to a book called Board of the Rings, which was done by the Harvard National Lampoon, which is a parody of it, which is just so funny. So that's what I'm reading now, Board of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings. I'll keep an eye. I'm a
Oh,
big
it's hilarious. I'll lend it to you.
fan. Okay, deal. The weirdest thing on your desk right now
The weirdest thing on my desk.
that you can talk about.
I've got an ice hockey puck. I've got a back scratcher because everyone should have a back scratcher, and I've got a little tube, which Dr. Rip's Essential Beach Book sunscreen. That my publishers came out to help people buy the book at bookstores this year, and I have no idea whether it's working. I don't even know if the sunscreen works, but it looks good.
It looks good. It's very cute. It's a for our listeners, it's a very, very small bottle of sunscreen.
One use only, I think.
Very beautiful. Okay, favorite movie.
I'm tempted to say, and I'm tempted to say The Hangover because it just makes me laugh. But actually, my favorite movie is a movie that most people haven't heard of. It's called Midnight Run. And I think it came out in the 80s, mid 80s. And it's got Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. And it's about Robert De Niro's this bounty hunter who's got to track down Charles Grodin, who's an accountant who was embezzling from the mafia or some criminals. And it's a funny, funny movie. It's almost like a road trip comedy. And Robert De Niro always wanted to do comedy. And I love it. And I always remember watching this with my dad, and we just laugh our heads off. So I haven't seen it for a while, but I think it would last the test of time. Midnight Run.
Midnight Run. Cool. Coffee or tea?
Neither.
Neither. How do you
Yeah.
survive in academia with neither?
I don't know. Not very well. The first cup of coffee I had was about 6 years ago at the morning of the auction where we bought our first house. And we paid this massive amount for this tiny little tiny cottage. and I just felt like vomiting in the bush. So I don't drink coffee much anymore.
Fair enough. Okay, and this is the end. Thank you very much, Rob, for your time today. It has been great having you in Coast to Cast.
No, it's been great chatting, Anna, and hopefully we can chat some more sometime.
And thank you, everyone, to our listeners for following us in one more episode of Coast to Cast. I hope you have enjoyed it. Please follow our podcast and give it a lot of stars, favorite, review. I don't know what you do, but anyway, help us spread the word and see you soon. Bye.